From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. The federal government is shut down, and with negotiations over the Affordable Care Act subsidies and Medicaid funding at an impasse, there's no end in sight. We know Nevada's roughly 22,000 federal workers have not received a full paycheck since September. Now it appears a much larger swath of the population may soon be affected. That's because on Saturday, November 1st, approximately 500,000 Nevadans who receive food aid through the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, will not get their benefits. That means a loss of roughly $90 million in federal funding for food assistance. To help us better understand what this means to Nevada families, I turn to Pieran Takes. She's the Director of Health and Social Policy at the Kenny Gwynn Center for Policy Priorities. She's also one of the authors of a recent report examining food security. Pieran Takes, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
Pieran, when we talk about food insecurity, what are we talking about?
So we're talking about individuals who have either restricted or uncertain access to a sustainable food source. When we're talking about extreme food insecurity, those are individuals who are living in low income or low access areas.
So do we know how many people qualify as food insecure in the state?
Yes. So in Nevada, we sit at a slightly higher rate than the national average. The national average is just over 14%. And Nevada has just over 15% of its individuals living in food insecurity. And so that amounts to just over 480,000 Nevadans living in food insecurity.
And how did you get to that number?
Our data is based on national data. We rely heavily on USDA data. They issue a report annually, the Household Food Security Report. They have recently announced that after 30 years of issuing that report, it'll no longer be issued, which has significant impacts in understanding food insecurity in our communities, both in Nevada and nationally. It's how we understand which individuals are living in food insecurity. It's how we understand how we're going to address food insecurity. And more than that, it helps us track how effective we are in addressing food insecurity through policy initiatives.
So roughly 500,000 people do not have access to enough food. Do we know who these people are, where they're at?
So jurisdictionally in Nevada, it's widespread. We know that 15% is the average statewide, but that's about how it spreads throughout our counties in Nevada. Clark County has a high rate of 15%, closely followed by Washoe County at 13%. And then when we look at our rurals, a few of those rurals come really close to 20% of their households facing food insecurity. That includes Nye County, Esmeralda County, Mineral County, and Eureka County, with the remainder of those rural counties sitting right around 15%. So it affects urban populations and rural populations about the same statistically in Nevada. But we know, of course, accessing food in urban areas and rural areas are really different. So the solutions to food insecurity in those populations will look really different.
The largest government program aimed at preventing food insecurity is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. Just how important is that program when it comes to addressing hunger in Nevada?
It's significant. So of the 15% of Nevadans that are living in food insecurity, 38% of that population is above the SNAP benefit line. So to state it another way, the remainder of that population is qualifying for SNAP. It's a significant portion of our population. In Nevada, just over 500,000 individuals rely on SNAP. And we know those are the individuals that are not just eligible for SNAP benefits, but that are seeking them. So there may be individuals in Nevada that are living in food insecurity and may qualify for SNAP, but didn't seek benefits.
We talk about SNAP a lot, but I don't know if many of us understand how it actually works. So give me a brief overview.
Sure. So it's a benefit program that's based on household income, assets, and expenses, and then provides benefits to families to be used to maintain a minimally adequate diet. So this is supplemental. It doesn't fully provide enough for a household to be maintaining a healthy diet. It's meant to be supplemental. And when we're looking at it from an economical perspective in Nevada, it's inputting approximately $92 million per month into Nevada's economy. So it's significant in what it is providing to the economy in Nevada, but also to food security and dietary intake for those individuals that receive SNAP benefits.
There's also this thing called the Nevada Food Security Strategic Plan. What is that, and how does it fit into the overall system?
Yes, so the Office of Food Security supports the Council on Food Security, which is a voluntary public body in Nevada that has been tasked with developing a strategic plan to address food insecurity in Nevada. And they've done so. They have recently updated their strategic plan. I think the most recent update came out in 2023. It provides a strategic vision for how Nevada can address food insecurity. Now, an aspect of it that's worth noting in Nevada is that while this public body has been tasked with developing that strategic plan, there's not an entity that has been tasked with specifically implementing that plan. Many of the responsibilities fall on different agencies and different community partners. And so, what Nevada lacks is something statutorily that authorizes a body to move that plan forward uniformly.
Break that down for me. What does that mean?
So it means that we rely heavily on our community coalitions, and that is really what the landscape in Nevada looks like. There's individuals that do receive benefits from our government programs, from SNAP, from WIC, but a lot of the work being done in food insecurity is being done on the local level through coalitions like the Food Banks, Northern Nevada Food Bank, Southern Nevada Food Council. Throughout the state, we have these community coalitions that are really working to fill the gap as far as a policy landscape in Nevada.
As you mentioned earlier, SNAP plays a vital role in addressing hunger in the state. Do you have any sense of how communities will be affected if SNAP benefits aren't available next month?
We don't know the impact of this government shutdown on food insecurity. What our report looked at is really a baseline of what food insecurity looks like in Nevada. And we know that we sit above the national average on food insecurity. We also know that our community coalitions and food banks are primary actors in addressing that food insecurity. So when you take that in combination with understanding that not just the 15% of Nevadans that rely on SNAP will be now put into a position where they don't have those benefits, in addition to federal employees who may be affected by the shutdown and their lack of paychecks, it places a huge burden on the safety net that those coalitions provide. And I think it's a huge ask to ask them to fill that gap.
Pierin Takes is the Director of Health and Social Policy at the Kenny Gwynne Center for Policy Priorities. Pierin, thank you so much.
Thanks, Phil.
As you heard, their community organizations like Three Square and the Food Bank of Northern Nevada likely will have to step in and make sure more than 500,000 Nevadans don't go hungry during this government shutdown. It's a massive undertaking. So what are these organizations doing to prepare for the increase in need? I toured one facility to find out. It's a busy day in the Food Bank of Northern Nevada's warehouse. Order pickers are steadily loading pallets with boxes destined for local food pantries. Some pallets get more canned goods, others staples like rice and beans. And there's always a demand for meat and dairy. Each order is packed according to the needs of the pantry it's going to. Jocelyn Lantrip is the Food Bank of Northern Nevada's marketing and communications director. She says the organization is busier than ever.
We are seeing the highest numbers of need that we've seen ever in the 42 years of this organization. We're helping 160,000 people every single month, and we are definitely expecting that to increase.
That's because SNAP benefits are now on hold until the government shutdown ends.
We have 77,000 people who are not getting their SNAP benefits November 1st or in that month, and so those folks are going to be looking for emergency food, and so our partners, our distributions are how they'll get it.
This rise in demand comes as food banks and related charitable organizations across the country struggle to adapt to federal grant cuts. The Food Bank of Northern Nevada, for example, disbursed more than 26 million pounds of food last year. That number will be closer to 23 million pounds this year. And while Lantrip is quick to point out that the food bank is working aggressively to secure more food through donations and partnerships, she also admits it's going to be impossible to fill the void created by the loss of SNAP funds.
I think at some point people will get less food. We'll have to distribute less. I hate that. But it's what we're looking at. I mean, this really can't go on too long.
To offset the loss of funds, Nevada state officials announced a plan to quickly direct nearly $39 million to local food banks in the hopes that fewer people go hungry. However, that funding might not be enough, and many SNAP recipients are already preparing for the worst.
And you're probably going to hear that bell a lot.
That's Joanne McCoy, the pastor of the Foundation Christian Life Center and CEO of a nonprofit grocery store and food pantry in Northeast Las Vegas called The Aftermarket. He's already seen a lot of new faces come into the store.
We've been averaging 200 a day, especially on Tuesdays, but we're expecting more than that today simply because of what's coming up on the first of the month. A lot of people have hit the panic button. What am I going to do? How am I going to feed my family? What's it going to look like?
Some of the food McCoy uses to stock the pantry comes from Three Square, which said it also plans to expand its emergency food response by setting up additional food donation sites and distribution events. And while McCoy has faith that his pantry will be fine, he's also been working for the last several weeks preparing for the inevitable flood of demand.
I've done inventory on what I have in backstock, and I've done an estimation on what I've been receiving over the weeks from the food bank and different organizations. But I've also been on the phone and the email reaching out to everybody that's ever donated food or financially to make sure that we're okay, no matter how long this thing lasts.
In the meantime, Nevada has joined a multi-state lawsuit seeking to block the federal government from suspending SNAP benefits. The suit against the U.S. Department of Agriculture argues that cutting SNAP benefits would be unlawful. But organizations like Land Trips and McCoy's aren't waiting to see the results. With thousands of families counting on them for help, they'll be scrounging for every crumb and dollar they can find until the crisis ends. Paul Boger, KNPR News. Across the state, officials are scrambling in case they need to offset the worst impacts of the federal government shutdown. So far, tens of thousands of federal employees have gone a month without a full paycheck, and now SNAP benefits are on hold, meaning hundreds of thousands of Nevadans may soon start wondering where their next meal may come from. So, are congressional leaders any closer to a compromise that will potentially reopen the government? I put that question to Democratic Congresswoman Dina Titus, the longest-serving member of the state's congressional delegation. Representative Titus, thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me.
This political stalemate appears to be heading into a second month. So what do you make of the shutdown?
Well, you know, the longest ever was under the first Trump administration, 35 days. This one seems to be dragging on. Nobody wants a shutdown. It could end in a minute if the Republicans were willing to talk about health care. That's a crisis that's been created. But it's not just going to be health care. Now it's going to be hunger. Now it's going to be housing. Other things are going to start to fall by the wayside. I'm in the district. I feel like I could be doing more things here than sitting around back there waiting for them to reopen. I'm not getting paid, but our offices are open so people can call us for help, even though a lot of the government agencies have laid people off.
What is the shutdown situation in Nevada? Do we know how many people or what agencies are actually affected?
Well, I'll tell you the most recent one that is really disturbing is out at the Nevada test site. Part of the nuclear defense organizations that oversee the stockpile, check for radiation, determine if other countries are testing, that they've laid off a number of people there. Now, that's a question of national security. They're laying off people in special ed at the Department of Education. That certainly impacts Nevada. I was just at an event this morning for the disabled. Today is Disability Awareness Day. They are going to be hurt by that. You've got some of the IRS folks laid off, so it makes it harder to get through on the telephone if you have a problem. Some people at the VA have been laid off, again, making it harder and longer to get services. So it impacts across the board. And that doesn't even refer to the direct transfer payments that people aren't going to get, like WIC and SNAP and Medicaid.
There has been some inconsistent messaging from Democrats about this shutdown. Leadership says that Republicans refusing to come to the table on ACA benefits and on Medicaid funding, they're the ones who have shut down the government. Individual representatives say that it's the Democrats standing up to Donald Trump. So where do you fall on this spectrum? You know, which is it?
Well, I don't think that two are mutually exclusive. But if you'll remember, I'm the only part of the only member of the delegation who was there when we voted for Obamacare. So I remember what it was like in Nevada when we had one of the highest rates of uninsured in the country. And so I don't want to go back to that. People were going to the emergency room, people couldn't afford insurance, people were dying because they couldn't get health care. And so fighting for health care to me is worth it. I think of health care as not a privilege, but as a right. So I have nothing good to say about Donald Trump, but on the other hand, I think health care is where you have to draw the line.
The House has not held a vote since September 19th. You mentioned you've been in the district during that time. What are you hearing from constituents?
Well, I attended the Indivisible rally. They want you to fight. They think this is worth fighting for. I hear a lot of concern from constituents about, well, what am I going to do when my SNAP stops, or when I can't get WIC, or when I can't get that what I've been depending on all this time? They're scared, they're worried. We had a town hall with women the other night. These kind of cuts disproportionately hurt women, and add to that the going after women's rights for abortion questions. They're scared and they're worried. So I think it's good that I'm here to listen to people, to try to reassure them, and to offer what help we can on an individual basis with casework.
Federal workers have not received a full paycheck since September. SNAP benefits, which are normally sent to recipients on the first of the month, that's not going to happen. What are you hearing from Democratic leadership? Play this out for me. How do you see this ending?
Well, you've got Schumer, who's holding the Senate together and says they are not going to cave. I don't know what'll happen there. And so far, the Democrats have held strong for health care on the House side. But when things start to get harder for people, Democrats care more about that than Republicans do. So I think there'll be some public pressure to look at what we can do to get those benefits back. Maybe that means opening the government. I don't know, but it's going to hit. It's like a perfect storm. All these things are going to hit at the same time, and it's going to really impact Nevada because we have a lot of people on those depend on those services. One fifth of the population gets SNAP benefits here in the state, and we know what a difference Obamacare made. And if you don't extend those credits, those tax credits, they're not going to be able to afford insurance because those rates will double at least for some people.
Republicans have made the argument that Democrats should just come to the table, pass a clean resolution, and then the discussion about healthcare subsidies can happen. So I'm curious, in that vein, what do you think is the future of healthcare if the Affordable Care Act isn't the law of the land?
Well, it's going to be devastating, and you're going to go right back to big pharma, big medicine, making big money, and people getting left behind. You will have people with no insurance going to emergency rooms where they get care. That's more expensive and not as good as if you've had maintenance all along. You'll not have people going to get preventive care, like whether it's obesity for diabetes or checks for breast cancer. All of that will go by the wayside because that was covered by Obamacare. And some people think, well, I'm not on Medicaid. I'm not on an Obamacare plan. I got private insurance. Doesn't affect me. That is not true because in order to pay for those people without the care, your rates are going to go up too. So the Republicans have been saying back since they first passed Obamacare, oh, that they wanted to get rid of it. And 100 times we have voted on Republican bills to either destroy or defund or redesign Obamacare. And they always say they got a plan, or I got some ideas about a plan, or we're working on a plan. Well, they don't. They obviously don't because all these years they've never, ever come up with anything. You remember that iconic scene where John McCain walked on the Senate floor and did the thumbs down because he was in a health crisis himself and knew the value of insurance. He wasn't going to vote to do away with Obamacare.
As we're having this conversation, there has been back and forth between the federal delegation and Governor Joe Lombardo's office about ways to fund SNAP in the coming weeks. You were in state government for years. You are very familiar with the programs and the processes. In your estimation, in your opinion, what can the state do to ensure that hundreds of thousands of Nevadans who rely on this funding don't go hungry?
Well, the state has the strongest rainy day fund it's had in years. The Treasurer Conine has invested that very well, and so it's a large amount of money. You could dip into that rainy day fund to try to provide a little temporary coverage. Now, that's not the solution, but at least that would relieve some of the immediate pain. I think the Treasurer wants to do that. The governor doesn't. He says the state can't, but you know, they keep talking about a special session. What would be more important to deal with in a special session than to provide the machinery so that those funds could be used? All you're hearing about is the movie tax. It seems to me you need to be talking about what you're going to do to feed people. And that seems to take precedent, but you're not hearing much about that.
Democrat Dina Titus represents Nevada's 1st Congressional District. Representative Titus, thank you so much.
Thank you.
KNPR also asked 2nd District Congressman Mark Amadei to join us. He's Nevada's sole Republican in Congress. He declined our invitation. However, his office did provide this statement. Quote, there are consequences to shutting the government down, and the real pain is setting in. Nearly 6 weeks ago, my Republican colleagues and I in both the House and Senate voted to fully fund the programs Americans rely on and ensure every federal employee and member of the military gets paid. This shutdown was completely avoidable. So when I hear people suddenly saying after this amount of time, oh my God, the shutdown has consequences, I have to ask, where has a sense of urgency manifested itself to keep the government funded so far? End quote. Again, that was a statement from Nevada's sole Republican representative in Congress, Mark Amadei. Imagine you want to sell your house. It comes time to put it on the market, and you find that an out-of-state realty company already has the exclusive rights to list your property for the next 40 years. And try as you might, the only way to get out of that contract is to pay thousands of dollars. That's what happened to hundreds of homeowners across Southern Nevada. A Florida-based company named MV Realty would target unsuspecting homeowners, offer them a quick buck for so-called home assessments, and then pocket the cash once victims discovered what happened. The practice has since been outlawed in Nevada, but that 2023 law failed to void existing agreements, which left hundreds in the lurch. Patrick Blennerhassett has been following the story for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. I asked him when he started to hear about these contracts. So when did you first hear about MV Realty and these shady contracts?
Yeah, I had heard about this actually for a couple of years just through sources, but had never been able to talk to somebody who was actually locked into one of these contracts. And then we got a tip a couple months back from a lady named Terry Arnold, and she was sort of willing to tell her story. So that's kind of when we jumped on. But I have been hearing about these contracts for years. But as I said before, it's difficult to tell the story unless you've got somebody going through it. And Terry was definitely in the middle of it, that's for sure.
Talk to me about what Terry was going through. How do these contracts work?
Yeah, so they vary, but the general story is basically, you know, a local realtor calls up, you know, a friend of a friend or a source or somebody who knows the client and says, hey, do you want to make $1,500 quick and easy for an assessment on your house? And, you know, some people are skeptical of that type of stuff. They're like, okay, sign a contract, get some free money. That sounds too good to be true. A lot of these companies like MV Realty, they target seniors. And so they sort of prey on sort of that aspect of it. And so they come to your house with the local realtor, which kind of gives it that feeling of like, okay, I can trust this person. You sign a contract, you get a check right away for a little bit of money, $1,500, $2,000. And then you don't think anything of it until what happened to Terry Arnold was she went to go take out a business loan using her house as collateral. And basically the bank said, you know, there's a cloud title on your property, which is essentially a lien. And so what these companies do is when you sign this contract, you're essentially signing a 40-year exclusive listing agreement with this company. And so if you're trying to do anything with the house, to sell it, to take out money against it regarding your equity, instantly this company sort of comes in and says, okay, if you want to do this, that's fine, but it's going to cost you $15,000. And I don't know a lot of people that just have $15,000, $20,000 lying around that they can throw at something like this.
So this company would approach homeowners. Was it right after people bought their homes and they were already signing a lot of paperwork? Or were these people who had already been in their homes for a while?
They sort of target older homeowners. It's essentially, for lack of a better term, it's a scam. And they target people that they know that they can potentially, especially someone like, you know, Terry, older people who are on fixed incomes, pensions, they're widows, you know, they're happy to have somebody come to their house and sit down and chat with them. They really do dupe these people into signing these contracts. And I would assume their idea is that they don't actually ever want to be the listing agent. They just want the contract so they can get the buyout when this person tries to either sell the house or do anything with it.
So what does MV Realty have to say for itself? Have you reached out to the company at all?
Yeah, so we obviously reached out to them. We didn't hear back. We did, however, get some emails from Terry about her sort of correspondence with them. And they essentially said, even though this practice has been outlawed in the state since 2023, the language in the assembly bill was not strong enough to bring the grandfathered contracts in. So MV Realty has essentially said to Terry, and I would assume a number of other people, even though this is illegal, you're still locked into this, which is pretty crazy to think about. So a practice that is now essentially illegal, still applying to some homeowners in the state.
You mentioned Assemblywoman Heidi Kasama. She's a Republican from Las Vegas, and she was the author of the bill that made this practice, these contracts, illegal. She was quoted in your article. What does she have to say about these contracts and the 800 or so people who are still living under them?
Yeah. She was really helpful. She was actually with Berkshire Hathaway back when, I believe it was 2022, when they first started noticing this. She would have agents closing on properties, and then all of a sudden this lien would come up out of nowhere. And so after it started happening a couple of times, she sort of said, you know, what's going on here? And kind of basically dug it up. And now that she's assemblywoman, she's essentially sort of taking that issue and moving it into law. One thing that was interesting was that she did say that she reached out to the attorney general back when she first noticed the issue and didn't really get a lot of traction with them. She thought it was a consumer protection issue, so the AG should obviously spearhead something like this. However, according to her, you know, the AG hasn't shown any appetite for this. I did reach out to the Attorney General's office, and they simply said that they are aware of the company and they received complaints of the company. However, they didn't want to comment further on it or didn't offer any further comment.
Do you know if she's planning to bring a bill maybe next session that would bring these people some relief?
Yeah, no, I don't know at this point, and I don't know where this story goes, because, you know, as MV Realty pointed out to Terry, these people are still locked into these contracts. So the bank is still saying that these contracts are part of the title. I would say, yeah, I would assume that would be the next sort of avenue for it if the attorney general doesn't seem to have an appetite for it. But yeah, I guess it's anybody's guess as to where this goes from here. And in the meanwhile, you know, there's literally hundreds of people in the valley, some of them who may have no idea. They may have completely forgotten that they signed a contract. They just haven't, you know, gone to sell their house or do anything. So this is something that could continue to kind of trickle in as an issue over the next couple of years, for sure.
Now, MV Realty is no longer operating in Nevada, but they still have these contracts. Of course, Nevada wasn't the only state that this company was operating in. They were in California, Georgia, Florida. What's going on in those other states? Are people living under similar circumstances?
Yeah, a number of other states took legal action against them, Georgia being a big one. Some of them, the judgments were so bad against MV Realty that MV Realty had to pay these people back the money that they forced them to pay in the contracts. So there's definitely been traction in other states, California as well, Florida, and they've all kind of basically ended up in the same place, which is that, you know, the state deems that this practice is illegal, shouldn't continue, and that in the large part, these homeowners should be given their money back if they were forced to pay money to get out of these contracts. However, in terms of our state, as I said before, and as you mentioned, Heidi Kassama is the only one sort of championing this right now, so.
Patrick Blennerhassett is a real estate and housing reporter for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. Patrick, thank you so much.
Awesome. Okay. Thanks so much.
I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. To get a glimpse of Las Vegas's homegrown cultural talent, look no further than the Las Vegas Academy of the Arts. The CCSD Magnet School is where students specialize in music, dance, theater, and the visual arts. And they're not shy about showing you what they can do. The school features more than 140 live performances a year, from student combos to large-scale theatrical shows like Bram Stoker's Dracula, which debuts November 6th. And the LVA's biggest concert of the year happens today, October 29th, at the Smith Center. This marks the school's 13th consecutive year performing there. And here to talk about this wellspring of talent is LVA's developmental director, Megan Franke. In the past, she worked more directly with the students as the director of vocal activities and the chairperson for the Music Conservatory.
Megan, welcome to State of Nevada.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for being here. What does it take to be a Las Vegas Academy student? Is it something more than talent?
It's passion. It's dedication. A 7 a.m. start time located in downtown, a long bus ride definitely involves dedication. It's a willing spirit. It's a kind student. So I think all of those things rolled in with talent, talent helps, makes a great LVA successful student.
And how important is live performance to the LVA curriculum?
It's everything. It's the centerpiece to what we do. We put on hundreds of performances and gallery shows a year. We don't have sports. I always joke we would be horrible. We would not be competitive in any real sense. But our shows are literally world-class professional level shows.
How often do students perform in a given year?
It depends on the major, but in the dozens, I would say. There's a lot of opportunity to be on stage and show your work and do what you love to do.
And where on campus are all the different ways that the students can see their classmates perform?
Yeah, we have three theaters, three fully functioning theaters. We also have a stage in our quad that we do, outdoor pieces and stuff. And then we perform in the community.
Are there performances that happen during school hours just for the students? Could a student see maybe a jazz combo or a dance piece during their lunch?
It happens literally all the time. Wow. I always joke we don't have fights, we have dance battles. And it's like High School Musical on our campus.
Which ones are the most popular?
Dance is very popular. I would say many of the music shows have huge followings. Our annual musical, I would say, is a big draw as well.
So let's talk about the October 29th concert. That's this evening. It's the 13th annual LVA Showcase at the Smith Center. How did this run of shows there begin and how has it evolved?
When the Smith Center came into being, my colleagues, Brian Downey and Carl Reinertz, and I really looked at each other and said, we got to make this happen. Our kids need to be on this stage. And truly, we've played and sang in every gorgeous concert hall in the country. And the Smith Center is at the top of the list, and it's a mile from our campus. So we knew we got to get in there. We need our kids to have this opportunity. And the Smith Center was so generous and has really partnered with us in a super meaningful way to let our kids shine on this glorious stage.
That's Megan Franke, a longtime educator and now development director at Las Vegas Academy of Arts, the downtown arts-centric magnet school that requires students to audition for acceptance. It also puts on more than 140 performances a year, including its 13th annual Smith Center concert. Tonight's is called Choose Love. Here to talk about it is one of the show's co-conductors and LVA's Music Conservatory Chair and Director of Bands, John Seaton. John, welcome to State of Nevada.
Thank you so much for having us.
As a co-conductor for the concert, how did you envision Choose Love? What did you want to accomplish with the program?
It's a collaboration with myself and my colleagues in the choir and orchestra departments. We always try to pick a theme that's going to connect with the audience and kind of a bigger image than just cool music, but let's find something to tie it all together. You know, the band has this great piece that I think we'll talk about a little bit. It's called Vital Signs by Viet Quang. The idea with that piece is there's, you know, a musical sine wave, a tone we would think of with that. And also with the sine wave, we could think of like a heartbeat. And the composer specifically wrote this piece to kind of evoke both of those images. And it was a love letter to his father who had just passed away. And that's where some of the heartbeat elements come in. That's on the band side of things. On the choir side of things, there's a world premiere of a new orchestration of a piece by Kyle Peterson. The orchestration's by J. David Moore. But that piece is titled I Choose Love. And so again, this kind of heart element and that being the unifying theme behind the concert, it actually kind of came together really easily.
How many students will be performing during the show?
I think we have about 250, and that's in the band, the wind ensemble, the choir, and the Philharmonic Orchestra.
What are the other pieces being performed, and what made you choose them?
So there's another piece being performed by the orchestra, and it's titled Carmen Fantasy. You've probably heard this done on other instruments, but this one is unique because it is being performed on double bass, which is usually a section instrument, you know, in most people's minds, not really a solo instrument, though. This artist has made her career bringing double bass into the conversation as more of a solo instrument. That's one of the other featured artists. And then I'll hand off to Megan because she had a former student who's coming in to sing with the choir.
So BYU Vocal Point, which is their male a cappella group, has done this gorgeous arrangement of Nearer My God to Thee. And then it features an outstanding tenor soloist. And I think when the thought came to do this piece, there was one voice in Matt's mind, Matt Ossley's mind, and it had to be Christian Shelton, who's one of our former students. If you want to be truly moved and inspired, this would be the voice and this would be the piece for sure.
John, what do you want the performing students to take away from this concert experience?
I always want them to have a good time. I think for them, a good time tends to be sounding amazing in a world-class venue. And I think this is just a chance for them with the guest artists, with this concert hall. You know, it's not a simulation anymore. They get to live the life of a professional artist as we put on this concert. You know, just connect with what they're aspiring to do in the future and get the chance to really be heard in their best possible light. We're so lucky that we get to do this concert at the Smith Center. And give the students the real experience rather than just saying someday. You know, that day is October 29th and it's happening.
John Seaton is the Music Conservatory Chair and Director of Bands at Las Vegas Academy. He's also a co-conductor of Choose Love, the 13th annual LVA concert at the Smith Center. That's this evening. We'll have a link to that show at KMPR.org. Here also with us is Megan Franke. She is the Development Director at LVA. Megan, John, thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Being chronically online is an ongoing problem for Generation Z. KUNR's James Perez brings us the story of one UNR student who's trying to figure out what it means to step away from his phone in a world that's always online.
Drink. I'm gonna do a pink drink.
That'll be all.
Can I get a name real quick?
It's late afternoon at Cameron Cobbin's apartment. The 20-year-old just got home from his journalism class. He immediately hops on his couch, opens his phone, and begins scrolling through TikTok. Before he knows it, hours have passed. It's not lost on Cobbin how this constant usage drains his energy.
I think for mental health, sometimes it just gives me like insecurity issues. I'll see guys with like the perfect physique, someone like being able to remain active all the time.
Cobbin's habits are far from unique. Across college campuses, Gen Z students spend hours online every day. For them, it's considered normal, but it comes with hidden costs. When asked if Gen Z is chronically online, John Indom, a 19-year-old criminal law student from Las Vegas, says,
Is the sky blue? Of course. They always on their phone, always on the Instagrams, the Snapchats, man. Like, it's just normalized in this generation.
Some Gen Zs think they can be on their phones while also working on other tasks. But in reality, they focus on their screens more than anything else. Aaron Boyson, an associate professor from the University of Minnesota Duluth, believes Gen Zs are set up to fail in this technologically developed world.
The human brain is a master at switching tasks very fast, so it seems like you're multitasking, but you're really not. You're just good at switching back and forth, back and forth, back and forth.
The effects of chronic scrolling also impacts productivity. Students report feeling fatigued, distracted, and disconnected from people around them. Soleva Soriano, an 18-year-old biology student from Las Vegas, has noticed these effects in her own life.
I definitely feel that, what is it, the brain fog? I feel like it's definitely like, makes me feel like more sleepy and just like wanting to just stay in bed longer. So it makes me feel less energetic.
With all these negative consequences of being constantly online, some students realize they need to take control of their own habits. Log Off, a national movement, focuses on getting youth to improve their online habits. They do this by getting young people to move away from screens and having in-person interactions. Tariq Lawal with Log Off says the organization hopes to help youth build healthy relationships with social media platforms.
But Log Off basically exists to help people see the negative impact that social media can have on them and how to avoid those negative effects, which can affect their self-esteem, their mental health, their relationship with other people in their lives, and so much more, even their academics.
As the sun begins to set outside of Cobbin's apartment, he puts his phone down and reflects on lost time.
I guess managing your time and being able to recognize when something is getting out of hand on social media and like knowing how to de-escalate wherever you are.
For many students like Cobbin, phones are part of daily life. He says being aware and having media literacy helps combat the issues of being chronically online. James Perez, KUNR News.
There's no shortage of what to see, hear, and do at any time in Nevada. Here to filter out a few of the best options is KNPR's Mike Privat, who covers arts and culture and entertainment. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Paul.
We've got a season premiere pretty deep into the fall art season.
Sort of. About a month ago, we spoke about the Las Vegas Philharmonic performing a concert full of Looney Tunes music, and that was technically the first concert of the fall. But they're calling their November 1st concert opening night or opening weekend, depending on what promotion you're looking at. And with this being a heftier program, I can see why they're doing that. This weekend's show at the Smith Center will be the first of the season conducted by artistic consultant Leonard Slatkin. And there are at least two selections here that are worth talking about. The obvious star of the program is Symphony No. 5 by Beethoven. You know the one, Paul. It starts with dun-dun-dun-dun, and it goes on for four movements. But the preceding selection is very interesting. This is a work by John Corigliano, and it's called Mr. Tambourine Man. And yes, that is inspired by Bob Dylan. But Corigliano claims that he has never heard Dylan's music. The lyrics of Dylan, however, moved Corigliano to create a classical work that matched the emotion of the words he was reading. So the composer starts with Mr. Tambourine Man. He picks six other Dylan chestnuts, and voila, there's a seven-movement suite that will be complemented by guest soprano Gila Plitman, who has sung this work before. So you have the classical banger, you have the classical reading, literally, of Bob Dylan songs, and oh, Dvorak's Carnival Overture to warm everyone up. So what else could properly start a season?
You would be the person to know. But I hear you want to talk about Basin and Range National Monument. I can't imagine that's where your event suggestion takes place.
No, though one doesn't need an event or excuse to visit Basin and Range, which is, for those who are unfamiliar, more than 700,000 acres of way-off-the-grid plains, mountains, desert plant life, and rocks in Nye and Lincoln counties. It's been said that it's the heart of Nevada, and that's what this art exhibit at Nevada Humanities Downtown Gallery is called. Now, exhibit curators and friends Paula Jacoby Garrett, Julian Kilker, And Chekel Salgado curated this multimedia exhibition of photography and video documentaries and interactive installations. All of this for the love of this mostly undisturbed remote area that has enjoyed national monument status for a decade. And I like how Kilker describes it. He says, the works on display explore geology and history, ranching and recreation, artistic interpretation, and the echoes of the nearby atomic testing. These pieces don't just capture the landscape. They also reflect the friendships, idea sharing, and creative energy that have shaped our engagement with the monument. And you can engage yourself Monday through Friday, 1 to 5 p.m. at Nevada Humanities Downtown Gallery.
That is a much shorter trip than actually going to the Great Basin. Finally, I know you want to talk about food.
Well, to be honest, Phil Rosenthal does. And the star of Somebody Feed Phil wants to talk to a Las Vegas crowd about the food he eats on his various travels. Now, as some of you may know, he was here earlier this year. The episode aired in June. I happened to be in Milpa the day after it aired, and the restaurant had it playing on a loop since he had actually featured that restaurant. So Phil will hopefully talk more about Milpa's magical corn tortillas and our dining landscape in general. And you'll hear him not only talk, but there's a Q&A where you can ask him questions as well. And that's November 1st at the Palazzo Theater.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Paul.